Vectis Radio, keeping you connected to the pulse of our island. Always fresh and always local. FM 104.6.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Vectis Radio Saturday afternoon show. My name is Kitty and I'm in the studio with
Dave.
And we have a visitor. Welcome to David Baldwin.
Hello.
Now, David, you've come to talk to us today about the Isle of Wight Armada.
Yes. Would you like to take me where you want me to go with it?
Yes. If you explain to us, I know this book has taken you many years to write, but tell us what prompted you to actually write it or to begin writing it.
Well, what prompted me to begin writing it was an experience. It was a gap year before going to university, and I thought I'd try and help the finances with the parents. And so I took a job with the Archbishop of Canterbury's library at Lambeth Palace, and it happened that in various dark corners of it, there were all kinds of books which it fell to me to help with the conservation of, and a number of those were Portolanos, which were a little like sort of guidebook maps to the coast. From the sea, so you had the profile of the cliffs and the hills and so on from a boat, and it had all the sounding depths and so on for the different tides, and a sea captain would calculate all this and put it in his portolano, which was a sort of essential thing to carry around. They weren't very big, usually leather bound, and what took my fancy was bringing one of these out of a bookshelf which was 16th century, and I wanted first of all why this was there. And I was told by the then librarian, a wonderful man, Mr. Geoffrey Bill, dead now, sadly, he explained that a lot of these mariners, when they returned from a voyage, wanted to give thanks to the Almighty for having been preserved on the voyage, and gave a valuable item to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so all these things were collected and never disposed of. So I delved into this lot, and one of these had a working compass in the back cover. And so as you opened it, there it was. A remarkable thing from the 16th century, a working compass. And it took my fancy. So thereafter, knowing the Isle of Wight, because I had family here, and used to visit a lot, I thought, well, something's not matching here, because I knew the coastline of Ventnor, and I knew what was being said about the Armada in various, really very reputable books. But I couldn't make the coastline and what I knew to be the case from various etchings and drawings, logs from ships, overseas archives, research, which I began to do in Venice in the arsenal there with the gunnery and so on. And I realised that these artefacts and their use did not, and their description in various logs and really of chroniclers at the time aboard these various vessels in 1588 did not match what was being said about it, until I discovered really the reason why. But we'll come on to that if you like to.
It's an interesting subject, and it must have been absolutely fascinating to start on this journey. How long has it taken you, in essence, to get through all of the maze of things to look through to find out all the information?
Well, it's taken really half a century, and every time I made a discovery, it usually didn't match what had been said about it. Primary sources of all sorts, whether or not it's what is discovered on the seabed, marine archaeology, whether it's documents in Spain or England or Venice or in Genoa or wherever, and those sorts of things, those primary sources, are pretty much essential. And when it came to reading the letter written by the governor of the Isle of Wight in 1588, after the Armada had passed the southern shores, he wrote at 8 o'clock in the evening from his desk at Carisbrooke Castle to the Earl of Sussex to explain what had gone on. And this appeared to be the basis of a lot of the misconceptions of these great historians. Because somebody had picked out part of the letter which said that this had occurred 6 leagues, which is about 18 miles in normal terms, 6 leagues along the south of the island. And the interpretation had been that that meant 18 miles or 6 leagues from the south coast of the island, which would make it almost impossible to see, certainly very difficult to hear, and that did not match the descriptions of listening to it from the island, sounding like a musket battle just round the corner. Mm. And those, in fact, were cannons being fired. So just the sheer numbers are quite mind-bending, really. And, of course, they eventually ran out, both sides ran out of cannonballs and ammunition at the end of the Battle of Dunnose. But it gives some idea of how much was expended. Anyway, those sources didn't match the visual and the auditory sources, which were people described in what was happening. And the people concerned were ranging from those who could hear it from the shore here, those on board vessels, being English and Spanish, as well as really quite the secondary sources, which are somebody being told something about it. But the primaries are much the best, the logs, the description of those who went along on the fleets. And there were some surprises. For example, when Francis Drake managed to make the first capture, which was the Rosario off Plymouth, he managed to nobble a very important aristocrat, Spanish aristocrat, Pedro de Valdez, mm-hmm. in 1588. And instead of putting him ashore with a lot of the rest of the crew and imprisoning those, he kept some aristocrats aboard from the vessel, including Pedro de Valdez. And this is the Revenge. And the Revenge proceeded right away along the channel, all the battles along the south coast of the island here, comprised really quite three major engagements, and ended up at Dover before Elizabeth I realised that Drake was carrying a Spanish aristocrat on the vessel.
Wow.
And she became very agitated and asked Francis Drake's cousin, who worked in the Queen's court, to go and tell Francis to put this chap ashore straight away, which eventually did at Dover, and shoved him in Esher Castle, or Esher Palace, where he was incarcerated from 1588 to 1593 before he was released.
Good grief, that's a long time.
It is, but he left a lot of rather interesting things about what was happening. He was interrogated about the Armada pretty much immediately while he was on the ship, about what the intentions were. So while this was all going on, the fleet was actually really were very near the Isle of Wight. So Pedro de Valdez was looking at what was going on, looking at what's happening to his own Spanish fleet from an English warship. Quite extraordinary. But going back to what eventually happened to him, he goes into print in a most extraordinary way. He is consulted by a person who's trying to put together the first Spanish-English dictionary and phrasebook. And he realises he hasn't quite got it right, so he goes round and asks the Queen whether or not he can go and pester Pedro de Valdez in Esher Palace. So he goes round there, and de Valdez ends up, by and large, revising the whole thing, really rewriting it.
Gosh.
And it's in the preface to it. It was published in 1591, before Pedro de Valdez was released in 1593. So that's a sort of really important information in that little preface about his role. But the interrogation is in a sequence of other documents which survive in the National Archives and so on. So there's a lot of really quite interesting sources coming from unusual places. But this business of what happened off the Isle of Wight, quite obviously what the governor was writing about at 8 o'clock in the evening after it all passed, where he mentions that they joined battle at 5 o'clock in the morning at dawn, when we know the fleet was off Chale then, roughly. And it had fought the Battle of Portland. Night had fallen. You don't sail at night if you can avoid it. And by dawn, there they were, floating around, really off St. Catherine's Point. And engagements took place there. The governor said that it lasted from 5 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the morning, by which time they were at Dunnose. And then they disappeared from sight finally at 3 o'clock. Well, the 18 miles, the 6 leagues, takes up that exact space. And rather interestingly, when we had this galleon come across, which I'd arranged to come from Huelva in Spain, we conducted a sort of inadvertent experiment, because you need to have a replica ship really of that era to find out what the tides are like when you're trying to sail it next near the Isle of Wight.
Indeed.
So went out there with it, with the harbour master event, very kindly took me out with some others in his boat, and so we were able to see that it was going roughly speaking about 3 knots.
Mm.
And that would correspond with some of the engagements having with some of the both sides being towed into battle by their own longboats.
gosh.
Which happened, yeah, because we didn't get the great storm, of course, till Dover. Until then, it was actually pretty much becalmed off the south of the Isle of Wight, which is why it took so long to pass by. And as it happens, the number two in the Spanish Armada, this wonderful mariner, Juan Martinez de Recalde, he didn't want to pass up the opportunity of making as much trouble as he could on the Isle of Wight, and raiding if he could, and possibly even landing. He did not agree with the boss of the fleet, Medina Sidonia, who was rather more staid in his views. And when it actually came to the Battle of Dunnows, and Frobisher couldn't find any wind, as it were, to fill his sails, he was caught between the Armada and Dunnows Point.
Oh, gosh. But
fortunately, he stayed there as long as he could to stop them, any prospect of them landing in Sandown Bay. So he, because of course, the back of that was Brading Haven, looking very different from what it is now in terms of the sea. So this is it. It gives an idea of the longboats being used, and then it gets a little bit of a breeze, which fills his sails. He's able to just get away from the flagship of the Spanish Armada, the San Martin, which is a wonderful ship, with Medina Sidonia on it. And Medina Sidonia decides to cut his losses and move away from engaging him. And when they finally, at the end of the whole Spanish Armada, and one or two, well, enormous losses everywhere, but one or two ships, well, more than that, do get back, and Recalde shepherds six of them back and his own ship, quite remarkable achievement, gets back to Corunna, pens a letter before he dies a few days later to the King of Spain, saying, do not put aristocrats in charge of boats, don't know anything about sea. Secondly, we should have gone in and finished off the engaging Captain Frobisher and chased him at least into a harbour and finished him off, as it were. But so Recalde was not a man for obeying instruction from above. And his signature is all over these engagements. And we know from some of the marine archaeology that there were some secret engagements that came ashore, basically, almost ashore, with loaded cannons still being found on the seabed off Tynmouth. There's one off Yarmouth, which has been misdescribed as belonging to an earlier wreck, and so on. So there's all these things yet to discover.
Thank you. We have our visitor still in the studio, David Baldwin, who's come to talk to us about the Isle of Wight Armada, amongst other things. Now, the descriptions you found from local people and others must have been incredible to read. How did you manage to disentangle the reports to find the true accounts? Because you mentioned some accounts didn't match their reported events.
Well, that is correct. A prime example is actually with charts, because the earliest known charts, the Astor sequence, which was lived for a huge amount of time at Hever Castle in Lord Astor's residence there, came to light, in public terms, when they were acquired by the nation in 2021 with a public appeal to help do so, and they're lodged in the Royal Naval Museum at Portsmouth. But those charts don't match the later ones, which apparently are based upon it. And the later ones move the fleet further away and so on. And so the earlier charts, really nice to see them when they did surface. Most people knew they were around, but hadn't had a chance to see them at all. So when they were acquired for the nation, the museum put them on display for quite a number of weeks, but not too many, because the light, irrespective of how you try and protect it, does fade it. So it was on for a short while. I'm sure many islanders went across and had a look at it. But chart number 7 has the fleet off St. Catherine's Point and Dunnows. That's the earliest depiction of it. So if you like, it's before anybody had reason to move it, either by putting crests somewhere or with a slightly different agenda, making it look as though the English were in charge of the whole event from beginning to end, never was a threat and this kind of stuff. So but the earliest version is really important, because it actually corresponds with Van Vroom and others who made these wonderful drawings and etchings of the fleet and indeed the Battle of Dunnows itself, which doesn't match this business of historians saying, well, it's all occurred 18 miles off the coast and was pretty much irrelevant to the proceedings. How wrong they were. And a primary example of that was the record left by Gilbert Lee, our Isle of Wight pirate, who was really a very, very good mariner and worked on the Quiet for for Walsingham, of course, who mm-hmm. had his connection with Carisbrook Church. At any rate, Walsingham had engaged him to watch Spanish movements, and in particular, watch for the gathering of the fleet off Lisbon. So he spent his time going over there and nobbling the odd boat and increasing his wealth and that kind of thing. when he did come into action, he saw the fleet leaving. So he was the man who raced back this end on the Rat of Wight, Isle of Wight vessel, whose home river was the Medina, and possibly Mead Hole, which is King's Reach area. So at any rate, when he got back to, he raced past St. Lawrence and Bonchurch and all that from the coast off Lisbon, and when he got to, he went straight for Portsmouth, and there he landed ashore, and for some reason or other he didn't take time to write down, although we know that he wrote notes about it, write down a complete sequence of what he'd seen, breakdown of the vessels, the different types of vessel and the numbers and so on. In fact, what happened was somebody else wrote down what he said. So it was exactly, he arrived, as it were, panting, got off, delivered what he had to do, which is, say, the fleet is on its way, and it's the following sort of disposition by the look of it, mm-hmm. Which we've noted down. And that was the signal for all the coastal commanders and Lord Howard of Effingham and so on to put all the defence into place immediately along the coast and to start the whole sequence of expecting the Armada to surface really very soon. If it hadn't been for that journey, that eyewitness account, then it would have been a very different world. But that eyewitness account was eyewitness but dictated. So it isn't him who actually wrote it down, but it is described, when you see it, as the deposition of Gilbert Lee about the departure of the Spanish Armada from Lisbon. So when you read it, it comes alive, but it tells you that primary sources are funny things. They come at you in different directions. Mm. In this case, we know that it's pretty much immediate, but it is once removed. And yet the vessel itself, see, that's once removed, because the Rat of Wight, of course, once he'd done that, Gilbert Lee appeared again on his boat, but under Effingham's squadron, coming past the south of the Isle of Wight, following the Armada, and he goes all the way along the English Channel, goes through the fireships business and all that, witnesses all that St. John's Roads off Calais, and then of course it goes up the North Sea with the great wind after the Armada's chopped its anchors and can't return down the Channel, and he chases it up as far as Newcastle, finally disengages there and following, comes back, and it's one of the two ships which are put in Deptford Reef, in the dock, actually, as examples for let people remember about the Armada. So you get the great Rosario, which is there, which Drake had captured, and you get the little Rat of Wight until they rot.
Oh.
Those are primary sources which we no longer have, but we do have the witnesses of the fact that we knew where they were, from all sorts of orders as to what they should be doing next, going up the North Sea and so on, and descriptions of which boat is in what harbour. So these descriptions coming from all different directions.
We have David Baldwin in the studio for the final bit of our chat today. Now, over to you, David.
Yeah, well, it's quite disappointing in the way that this is going to be the last part, because I could listen to you for the rest of the afternoon. One thing that the book that you've brought with you is fascinating. Where can our listeners get hold of a copy, please?
Yeah, well, I feel a bit uneasy about that. I haven't come here to sort of, as it were, to promote the book. But if somebody wants for the bravery to acquire it, it can be got at the Longshoremen's Museum in Ventnor, run by Sophie Blake down there, and by Medina Bookshop in Cowes, and those two locations have some copies, and we try and fill in when they've all gone. So those are the two places in the island that you can acquire it.
Brilliant. And we've heard all about the engagements that happened just off of our wonderful island here, but I'd like to talk to you about chickens and how they feature in this story.
Well, there's more than one way to find out what's happened at an event, in this case you can follow the animals rather than the humans. And if you work backwards, it's an extraordinarily helpful sequence of events. If you go to Shetland, you come across a form of chicken which has a sort of bouffant haircut at the top, which is very distinctive, and they lay green eggs. And these are called galleon chickens still because they came off a particular vessel. And to go back to the start of that, and we'll see why that's a really helpful sequence of events, Magellan, when he was trying to discover a way round into the Pacific via the south of South America, set off, and in 1519 he got near the bottom of South America, but he'd put in at several locations on the way to acquire food. And he did it usually by bartering for bits and pieces he'd got, a knife or bits of metal and stuff, which were helpful to the locals. And they would give him livestock or whatever he needed. Well, he acquired a load of Araucana chickens. Unfortunately for him, Magellan, he couldn't persuade one of his vessels to go with him through what became Magellan Strait into the Pacific Ocean. Instead, this chap turned round and went backwards to Spain. And on board his vessel were these Araucana chickens. And when he got to Spain, the King of Spain was very annoyed with him, so he had him reprimanded for desertion, as it were, for a short while. They actually was a very competent seaman, turned out to be quite a figure. But at the time, he was in disgrace. And these Araucana chickens were shoved on a farm. But they appear again in the story generations later, because come trying to get supplies for the Spanish Armada from all quarters of the Spanish colonies and influence, and indeed the Mediterranean, it was really quite a heroic effort trying to coordinate all this lot. You had to be careful with biscuits and things going off, that kind of stuff. But chickens were particularly important because, of course, you could not only eat them, if you didn't eat them, you could eat the eggs. So this farm was raided, and these chickens were put on board a vessel called the Grand Griffin. And we next hear what happens to that, because it appears off St. Lawrence, and it's pummeled by Captain Drake aboard the Revenge, who finds it lagging behind the Spanish Armada's main fleet at dawn, 5 o'clock in the morning, on the 25th of July in 1588. And so Drake goes for it. And he doesn't record this in his own logs, but it's in the Spanish logs, very interestingly, because it appears that Drake, very unusually, failed in this exercise of either sinking or capturing this vessel. And he's described as having gone round it three times and expended 70 shot, a lot of that being cannon and a lot musket. And before, a person we've already talked about, Juan Martinez de Recalde, who's on board a rather large vessel, the San Juan de Portugal, gets off that and goes on to one of the galleasses, which of course has sails and oars, four. They're like that sort of supreme ship, which of course we were frightened of, and indeed the instructions for locals here required them to go to the cliffside as a result of Governor Carey's instructions, and at night listen for the beating of oars in case of a coming ashore. It's all in his instructions. So those are that's the sort of vessel they were. And three of those came to the rescue of the Grand Griffin under Recalde and managed to wrestle it away from the proximity of the Revenge's pummeling of it and get it back into the Armada. But aboard that vessel were these chickens, and they didn't seem to get pummeled to death, because they survived throughout the entire proceedings and the Battle of Dunnows, and later on down the channel, the fireships, one of which, of course, actually provided by Governor Carey here, one of the fireships, one of the eight. Interesting story in itself. But anyway, they survived that, survived the great storm, taking them up the North Sea, and they go actually around Scotland and towards Ireland before the wind blows them back again, and they get wrecked on Fair Isle. And this vessel, the remains of which are still down there, and one or two cannons have been brought up and so on, a local museum. But Fair Isle was pretty much remote, and they managed to bump into that. But they got all the crew off the ship, and all these chickens strutted off it. And the Shetland Islanders kind of bore down on the island and grabbed the chickens, and they are still called galleon chickens, and they are Araucana chickens. And that's how they got to be in the Shetlands. So it's living history there, but it bonds the south of the Isle of Wight into it straight away. It gives you some idea what a primary source is.
Absolutely.
In this case, poultry.
Brilliant.
That's fabulous. Now, you said that virtually every part of the island had a role to play in 1588, and some long before the threat actually surfaced. Now, you mentioned earlier about the chap who was over there abroad and then scootled back really quickly to bring back information so that people could be ready to wait for them to arrive. But you said also that there were local island unsung heroes.
Yes, there were indeed. The preparation for this really went back to Philip II's, well, he wasn't a king then, he was prince in Spain, when he married Mary Tudor, came over to Winchester Cathedral for the marriage and brought a fleet which was bigger than the Armada. And, of course, he sailed it through the Needles Passage, anchored it in the Solent, and, of course, it went through all these diplomatic manoeuvres of gun signalling for deferral to the country you're coming to and so on. And that's what we repeated, of course, just the other day off the south coast.
Indeed.
Gun signalling being a particular form of diplomacy. And Philip ordered the high rate big ones to make the point that he was very honoured to come here and so on. So, at any rate, the fact is that was in 1554. And interestingly, he left some notes about that and advised that if any fleet was going to, as it were, approach the shores of this country, to do so not through the Needles Passage, but through what we now know as Spithead. Because
yes,
of his experience. And, of course, for a while he ran the navy along with Mary Tudor, and the English navy had to take instructions from a Spanish husband, interestingly. But anyway, come to later on to the question of every part of the island playing a role. Well, we know that on that occasion, not in 1854, but the next one, in 1575, there was a secret armada of 44 ships and four great ships, which were released along the southern coast of this country as a sort of way of establishing plumb depths and defences and everything else, under the guise of being weathering rather nasty storms in the Channel, so I have to come and seek refuge.
Yes.
And this lot was all planned, really, and executed by Juan Martinez de Recalde again, who came ashore secretly for a day down in Medina before meeting the governor, which he had to because he was sitting in English waters, can't get more English than the River Medina. But the Queen Elizabeth said, we've got to have the castle at Cowes have its guns trained on him. So that was it. Anyway, so we've got Cowes playing a role, it's really one of intelligence gathering all around the island. And we'll come to that some other time. But anyway, please.
Thank you so much for coming to see us, David. Now, we could talk for hours about this subject, I'm sure. And would you come back again and speak to us?
Well, if you can suffer it.
Yes.
Absolute honour.
Thank you so much for coming to see us. You're very welcome.
Well, it's a very good... I would say so. It's a splendid radio station.
Oh,
it's not only very hospitable, but a thoroughly professional exercise.
Well, thank you very much.
And I have to say, I think it's an aspect of the Isle of Wight which we really must savour.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.